So today we have a joint talk. From the first half will be by Cole Fury, and the second half will be by Mia Hughes. And then I think Cole comes in again a little bit at the end, and they'll tell us about their two recent papers in preparation. So please, whenever you're ready, take it away, Cole.
You know, first of all, thank you to everybody. Thank you to Latham, to Carol, and to Stephanie Mole for organizing this conference for us. And also thank you to everybody for showing up today. So my name is Nicole Fury, and today my collaborator, Mia Hughes, and I would like to tell you about some recent results that we found. So we decided to split this talk into two. So I'm going to give the first part of this talk, and then Mia is going to give the second part. And then after this, I'll have a quick comment to make at the end. So our talk today is entitled Division Algebraic Symmetry Breaking. And as the title suggests, Mia and I have been looking into particle models which are cast into the language of norm division algebras. So in particular, today we'd like to show you how you can use division algebras in order to break symmetries. Furthermore, I'd like to emphasize that these symmetry breaking methods don't seem to appear naturally when you write these particle models down in the standard formalism. So there does seem to be an advantage to viewing these models division algebraically. Okay, so this talk is going to be based on two papers which we're about to release. So the first one is called One Generation of Standard Model Fermions as a Single Copy of RCHO. And the second one is called Division Algebraic Symmetry Breaking. So this material was already presented for the Rutgers Mathematics Department quite some time ago in October. And also just recently at Perimeter Institute, so it's already up on PIRSA. Now, division algebraic symmetry breaking is by no means a new concept. So we're going to take a moment to describe some of the symmetry breaking patterns that a number of authors have found by isolating an imaginary unit. So perhaps the most well-known example appears in the early work of Gunaitin and Gersi. So Gunaitin and Gersi showed that the subalgebra of G2, which holds an octonionic imaginary fixed, can be identified with SU3 color. Then in 1999, Jeffrey Dixon proposed a model which starts with spin 1,9 plus SU2. And then he made use of two projectors based on octonionic imaginary units, and he used those to reduce this to spin 1,3 plus the standard model internal symmetries. And more recently, Michel Dubois-Violette and Ivan Todorov have been working on the exceptional Jordan algebra. And in this work, they demonstrate that the standard model symmetries can be obtained as the intersection of the SU3 plus SU3 and SO9 subalgebras of the exceptional Lie algebra F4. And this produces a commuting diagram from F4 to the standard model via either the SU3 plus SU3 or the SO9 subalgebras. And depending on which path you choose, we may either view their division algebraic symmetry breaking step as breaking F4 to SU3 plus SU3 or SO9 to the standard model symmetries. Now, later in 2019, Kirill Krasnov wrote an extensive analysis of complex structures. And among other things, he emphasized the statement that isolating an octonionic imaginary unit reduces SO9 to the standard model symmetries, in addition to showing an analogous quaternionic result that SO5 reduces to U2. Now, perhaps the result most relevant for what we're going to be discussing today came from Latham Boyle in 2020. So there, Latham looked at an SO10 model, which is embedded inside E6. And from there, he showed that isolating an octonionic imaginary unit can send SO10 to the left-right symmetric Lie algebra. Now, after Latham's work, after his result came out in June, then ours came out in October, so we're going to talk about that in a second. And subsequently, Ivan Todorov has been circulating notes where he identified the same result of SO10 breaking to the left-right symmetric model. And most recently, Kirill Krasnov has confirmed this transition in addition to showing the transition from the SO10 to the Patisse-Lie model. Okay. Now, throughout this seminar, we're going to be talking, of course, about the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and the octonions. So the thing I find most appealing about these algebras is not so much the fact that they're special. You know, of course, they're known to be the only finite dimensional norm division algebras over the real numbers. But more so, I find them appealing for pragmatic reasons. That is, in nature, they seem for some reason to be ubiquitous. For example, you'd be hard pressed to find a theory in physics that doesn't depend on the real numbers in some way. You know, we're so used to using the real numbers that we don't even realize that we're making a choice in number systems anymore. And likewise, the vast majority of quantum theories are built using the complex numbers. And whether physicists realize it or not, it's in fact quaternionic structure, or more precisely complex quaternionic structure, that underpins special relativity and electromagnetism. So some early authors of these ideas include Conway in 1937 and also, of course, Maxwell from the late 1800s. Now, furthermore, the octonions have been known to be useful for teasing out properties of the strong nuclear force now for decades. And as far as we know, it's Gunaitin and Gerci who were the first to point out that the octonions are good for describing SU3C transformations of quarks back in 1973. So in summary, these norm division algebras provide one rare example of a set of number systems that is simultaneously unique and yet still woven into the fabric of everything we see around us. So before we start, I'm going to have to set up some notation for you. So every time that you see the symbol I, you'll have to know that we're referring to the complex imaginary unit. And every time that Mia and I talk about epsilon 1, 2, and 3, we're really referring to the quaternionic imaginary units. And then when you see E1 to E7, these are going to refer to the octonionic imaginary units. Now, one thing I find unsettling about division algebraic symmetry breaking, including our version of it, is the question, why should it happen in the first place? That is, why should nature isolate one imaginary unit? You know, you could, of course, ask a similar question in standard particle physics. That is, you know, why should this particular Higgs field be chosen so as to break the symmetry in this particular way? Now, there is an observation that might end up giving us a clue, and it's related to the fact that multiplication of norm division algebras can lead to Clifford algebras. That is, every time you've got octonions multiplying octonions or quaternions multiplying quaternions, there's readily a Clifford algebra that arises. So for example, left multiplication by the octonions. So here's what that looks like. At the bottom here, we've got the one vector, or the zero vector rather. On the next level up is where we're going to write our one vectors. So these are given by left, they can be given by left multiplication by an octonionic imaginary unit written like this. So people might be more familiar with this notation of a left multiplication algebra, but I'm going to write them like this anyway. So we're going to write down six orthogonal imaginary units being left multiplied for our one vectors. On the next level up, we've got bivectors, and so on. So you can keep on building these multivectors until you get up to the top where you have six. Now, well, hold on, you might say, well, what happened to EJ7? Like, don't the octonions have seven imaginary units? Well, it turns out that if you you can show that the six vector always gives the same linear map as EJ7 up to a sign. So saying this carefully, when you populate the generating space with multiplication by orthogonal imaginary units, then the resulting Clifford algebra has a natural way to single out one octonionic imaginary unit. So does everybody know which Clifford algebra this generates?
Can I ask a quick question? Which one?
Which one? Sorry, which imaginary unit does it single out?
Rather than one, or what selects a special direction?
I was talking to me about this, and I feel like there's a perfect analogy actually. So it's kind of like musical chairs. So you're not picking out one. So you can think of the multiplication algebra as kind of, do you know the game musical chairs? It's this game where there's n chairs and there's n plus one children. And basically the adult who's playing the game turns off, the children are meant to go around the circle and they walk around the chairs in a circle. And when the adult turns the music off, then all the children have to sit down and there's obviously one child that is left, the poor child left standing. So what the kind of analogy for this is, like what the multiplication algebra is doing, it's not taking a child like, poor Susie, and taking her out and saying, you're the one that has to sit out of the game. Instead, what the multiplication algebra is doing is turning off the music. So by definition, the imaginary unit that is isolated is the one that didn't get a seat. It's the one that didn't get a spot in the generating space. I thought you might complain about this, so I am trying to be as careful as possible about it isn't choosing one particular imaginary unit. The thing that gets singled out is by definition the one that's left over.
Let's keep going.
Okay. All right. So this is the where did we go? Okay. So this is right. So which Clifford algebra does this? Did we already say this? It generates a Clifford algebra CL06. People might already know that. Okay. So as you know, octonions can also be right multiplied by octonions. So there's another way of writing down this CL6. So we can build the exact same thing. It's the exact same pattern. Here we get CL06 again, using right multiplication. Now, one interesting property of the octonions is that whenever you right multiply an octonion by an octonion, you can always re-express it as chains of octonions coming from the left. So for example, we can right multiply the octonionic imaginary unit E7. And it turns out that you can always rewrite it like this, where you've got all of the octonions are now being multiplied from the left. So this flipped operator is important enough for us that we're going to give it its own name. And so we're going to call it left multiplication by the operator E7, capital E7. So every time you see capital E7, this is the left multiplication version of right multiplying by little E7. Okay. So being able to re-express right multiplication by left multiplication is also trivially true for the complex numbers and the real numbers, because of course these are commutative algebras. However, this is not true for the quaternions. So let's consider now left and right multiplication by the quaternions. So again, we can left multiply the imaginary units epsilon J1 and epsilon J2. So these are going to give our one vectors. And then we have just one bivector here that is going to give epsilon J3 up to a sign. So again, if we populate the generating space with multiplication by orthogonal imaginary units, then the left multiplication algebra of the quaternions has a natural way to isolate one imaginary unit. Now, of course, we can also right multiply epsilon J1 and epsilon J2 and find a similar pattern. Now, in the left multiplication case, we have an incarnation of the Clifford algebra CL02. And of course, the same is true for the right multiplication case. But note now that this time we cannot generically re-express right multiplication with left multiplication. So in order to describe the full set of endomorphisms on H, then we're going to have to keep both. So for the quaternions, we have CL02 tensored with CL02. Okay, so what are the important things to remember for the rest of this talk? First thing is that anytime that you left or right multiply a maximal set of orthogonal imaginary units, you readily get Clifford algebraic structure. For the octonions, we got CL06. For the quaternions, we got CL02 cross CL02. And for completion, I should mention that we also get Clifford algebras for the complex numbers, it's CL01, and for the real numbers, CL00. So the second point is that when things are set up in this way, then the left and right multiplication algebras have a natural way to isolate one imaginary unit. And the third point is that in the case of the octonions, for the octonions, the complex numbers and the real numbers, you can always rewrite right multiplication entirely with left multiplication. But this is not true for the quaternions. And the final point to remember is that this capital E7 operator refers to left multiplication, the left multiplication version of right multiplication by little E7. Okay. So now that we've been introduced to these multiplication algebras, we'd like to somehow put them together and start talking about particle physics. So let's start out first by figuring out how many states we have in one generation. So in one generation, we've got a neutrino, we've got a charged lepton like the electron, we've got red, green, and blue up-type quarks and red, green, and blue down-type quarks. So that's 8. Now each of these are going to have spin up and spin down, so we're going to multiply by 2. And each of these, we're going to take each of these to have a chirality left and right. So in other words, we're going to include a right-handed neutrino. So again, we multiply by 2. So this is 8 times 2 times 2, or 32 complex degrees of freedom, or in other words, 64 real degrees of freedom in one generation. Okay, so we might now wonder, like, could there be a mathematical object out there which could capture the states of one generation into a single package? Well, what would happen if we were to now put all 4 of our norm division algebras together using a tensor product over R? Well, we get R cross C cross H cross O, which is 1 times 2 times 4 times 8 dimensions, or in other words, 64 real dimensions. So by tensoring together, we readily have an algebra which is the perfect size for one generation of standard model fermions together with a right-handed neutrino. Okay, so now some quick notational points. So RCHO is also known, of course, as a Dixon algebra. And furthermore, you may have noticed that RCHO is trivially equal to C cross H cross O. We just include the R for style. And throughout this talk, I'm going to shorten this even more by writing the algebra like this, CHO. So every time you see CHO, really what I mean is R cross C cross H cross O. Okay, so what happens now when we left and right multiply RCHO onto itself? Well, again, we get left and right multiplication algebras. That is, we get chains of RCHO elements multiplying onto RCHO, kind of like a space of operators acting on a state. Now, these left and right multiplication algebras can be brought into the form of a Clifford algebra. And in this case, we're going to get the complex Clifford algebra CL10. So when you repeatedly multiply RCHO onto itself, you can get CL10 structure. Now, this is great news because once you have CL10 structure, it means that we have ready access to all kinds of particle models. So CL10 sets us up to be able to describe the SO10 or the spin-10 model. And as a consequence, we have access to the Patisse-Salam model, the left-right symmetric model, and most importantly, the standard model. Okay, so just to recap, here's an algebra which is 64 real dimensions and therefore the perfect fit for one generation. And point number 2 is just by having this algebra left and right multiply itself, we have access to spin-10 and its subgroups. Which means that we have access to all kinds of particle models. Well, hold on, you might say, well, you know, CL10 models, those are already really well known. Like, are you really going to get anything new here that isn't already given to us by the usual CL10 formalism? Well, yes, we are. And the reason is because what we've got here is more than just CL10 structure. Of course, we've got CL10 with all kinds of extra octonionic and quaternionic substructure. So let me show you an example of what I mean here. So here's the usual way of writing down spin-10 generators in CL10, in a CL10 particle model. That is, you simply left multiply the 45 bivectors of CL10 onto your 32 complex dimensional spinner. So in this case, the irreducible representation of the Clifford algebra ends up transforming as a Dirac spinner under the spin-10 group. So this is the old way, or the usual way of writing down spin-10's action. Now, when we left multiply these vectors onto the spinner in this way, then we run into two problems. So the first problem is, of course, that this version of spin-10 has no substructure. And the second problem is that we find that the spinner transforms as a 16 plus 16 star. Now, this seems to introduce an issue when it comes to building spin-up and spin-down pairs. That is, it would be better for us if we had a 16 plus 16, in which case we could identify the first 16 as spin up and the second 16 as spin down. Now, Mia and I have a new way of writing down spin 10 generators in terms of RCHO, which have a much richer structure. And here's what they look like. So the S's here, these are real coefficients. And you'll notice that these generators treat all of the octonionic imaginary units and quaternionic imaginary units equally. So this is not a unique construction of spin 10 that works, but it's the one that we found that we find to be the most beautiful. Now our RCHO spin 10 generators clearly supply us with more substructure than the usual CL10 version. And furthermore, in our construction, one generation now transforms as a 16 plus 16. So it solves the spin problem. Okay. All right, so now these generators can be written in a more ugly, but yet more useful form like this. So this is gonna be useful for our purposes. It's the same generators, just shuffled around a little bit. So these R's here, these are real coefficients. The epsilons, those are quaternionic imaginary units, as you remember. The E's, those are octonions. This PL is a projector, which is going to preserve left-handed states, and PR preserves right-handed states. Okay. So now what we'd like to do is we'd like to use this quaternionic and octonionic substructure to break spin 10. But how exactly are we going to do this? Well, incidentally, there are several options available to us. And in our first version of this work, we were using Clifford algebraic grade involutions. But Mia and another collaborator, Beth Romano, who is probably here, suggested complex structures. So we went with that. So what is a complex structure? Well, a complex structure is something that generalizes the notion of multiplying by a complex I. So in other words, a complex structure is a linear map J on a real vector space for which J squared is equal to minus one. So now we just mentioned that these norm division algebras have, of course, you know, the complex I, we've got epsilon 1, 2, and 3, and then E 1 to 7. So each of these will make excellent candidates for complex structures. So the idea then is that we're gonna use these complex structures to break the symmetries down in a cascade. So there's going to be four possibilities that we're going to consider. The first one is going to be left multiplication by an octonionic imaginary. The next one will be right multiplication by an octonion. Next one will be left multiplication by a quaternion. And the final one will be left multiplication by the complex imaginary unit. So notice that these are all of the options that were available to us from the multiplication algebras, can be written down using left multiplication. Okay, so now we're ready to apply these complex structures. So the nice thing about this part of the talk is that you can see for yourself explicitly how this works. So here are spin 10 generators, and now let's consider a complex structure given by left multiplication by the element E7 onto our one generation psi. So this psi here represents one generation and it's written in terms of RCHO. Okay, so now when we require that the symmetry commutes with this E7, then some of these SO10 generators are going to survive and some aren't. So you can see for yourselves which ones those are. So this E7 for the first term, the E7, you can see it's going to commute with this term. So E7 anti-commutes with each of the EIs and EJs. So there's one EI and one EJ there. So we're going to get two negative signs, which are going to cancel. So the first term is going to survive. Now, when we look at the next two terms, you can see that there's no EIs or EJs. So these are going to survive as well. So the whole top row is going to survive. However, on the second row here, you'll notice that each of these have just one factor of ei. So they're not going to commute with e7, and so the whole bottom row is going to die. And this is what we're left with. So the first term here is going to give us an SO6, or in other words, an SU4. And the next two terms each give us an SU2, or in other words, together they make an SO4. So in other words, what we have here is SO6 plus SO4. Does everybody know which model this relates to? This is the famous Patisserie model. Okay, great. So let's move the Patisserie model up, and now we're going to repeat the process. So next we can consider right multiplication by E7. And now when we require that our symmetries respect this new complex structure, it's going to cut the symmetries down again. So the two SU2s, these are going to survive just fine. But this SO6 now is going to get knocked down to a U3. Now, incidentally, this is also a well-known model. Do people recognize what this one is? This is the left-right symmetric model. Okay, so let's move this up again. So we're going to repeat the process another time. And this time we're going to consider left multiplication by a quaternion. Now, I should mention that you should notice that there's a subscript R here on psi. So this little R is denoting the fact that the vector space being acted upon by epsilon 3 corresponds to the right-handed particles inside psi. So this is how chirality is going to be introduced in our model. Okay, so now commuting with this epsilon 3 in this way subsequently breaks our left-right symmetric algebra down to this subalgebra. Do you recognize those symmetries? Well, these generate the standard model symmetries together with the B minus L. So there, I didn't write out the U1 hypercharge in its complete expression because it got a little bit messy. But these, you can confirm those in our paper. Okay, so let's move this up one last time. So now we've just reached a standard model together with a B minus L, and we've made use of the octonions and the quaternions. So what's the last type of imaginary unit we have left? How about the complex I? So you should know that the complex I is a bit of a special case, of course, because I lives in the center of RCHO. So this is unlike with the quaternionic and octonionic cases. Okay, so this is my favorite part. Does anyone want to take a guess at what the final symmetry is going to be? When you take the standard model plus B minus L, written in this new RCHO language, and you require that it's invariant under the regular old complex conjugate, so just taking complex I to minus I, then we get the standard model's unbroken gauge symmetries together with a B minus L.
Can I ask a question? Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So in the previous steps, were you requiring that your group elements commuted with the...
Good question.
And now at the last stage, it's getting along with complex conjugation. Is that like a...
Yes, yes, that's a good observation. So yes, that's exactly right. And so there might be something a little bit unsettling about why do we have this one rule for the first set, and then there's this other rule for the last set with complex I. Of course, it's in the center. And if you make it commute with... it's obviously going to commute already with the symmetries. This is one of the things I liked about the original construction when we did it. It was in terms of Clifford algebraic grade involutions. And in that case, it's the same rule at every step. So the complex I doesn't stand out because, of course, you can think of the complex numbers as being CL01. And that's just complex conjugation then is just a grade involution. So in every case, every step, you can just view it as a grade involution. Yeah, good catch. Okay, so let's see. Now the reason why I find this exciting is that we know experimentally that the standard model breaks down to SU3 cross U1, but we don't know from a theoretical perspective why the Higgs should break down to SU3 cross U1 and not some other symmetry. So the hope is that invariance under complex conjugation might at least be part of the answer. Okay. Now, just as one final comment, I should mention that there is actually a richer structure, a richer story going on behind the scenes here. So, and there's a richer story than, you know, just these complex structures connecting these models. So this is something that we do plan to elaborate on in the future. In particular, you can see in more detail what's going on with this B minus L symmetry, which seems to be coming along for the ride, and also why this subscript R needed to appear as we step down from the left-right symmetric model to the standard model. Okay, so let's zoom out now and summarize what just happened here. So first of all, we found a new version of the spin 10 model written in terms of RCHNO. And we found that the subalgebra of SO10, which is compatible with the left octonionic complex structure, was given by the Patti-Salam symmetries. And then next, we found a smaller subalgebra still, which now commutes with the right octonionic complex structure. And this breaks Patti-Salam down to the left-right symmetric model. And then next, we found a smaller subalgebra still, which now commutes with a quaternionic complex structure. And this breaks the left-right symmetric model down to the standard model plus B minus L. And then finally, invariance under complex conjugation gives us a slick new way to go from the standard model plus B minus L to the unbroken gauge symmetries plus B minus L. And finally, invariance under complex conjugation here, so the hope in this last step is that this might lend new insight as to why the standard model symmetries break in the way that they do. Okay, so in summary, peering in from the outside, RCHO looks like an ideal mathematical structure for particle physics. I mean, it's 64 real dimensional, which is exactly the size of one generation of off-shell fermions together with a right-handed neutrino. Its left and right multiplication algebras realize CL10s, so we have ready access to spin 10 and its descendants. However, you might rightfully wonder if RCHO really provides anything extra that can't already be accomplished by CL10. And we show that indeed it does. In fact, we demonstrated how a cascade of complex structures connect SO10, the Patti-Salam model, the left-right symmetric model, the standard model plus B minus L, and the standard model's unbroken gauge symmetries plus B minus L. Now, these complex structures derive from the octonions, and then the quaternions, and then the complex numbers. Okay, so this is the end of the first part of our talk, and now Mia will tell you about other aspects of our model. In particular, she's going to recount what I believe is the first explicit demonstration of quaternionic triality in the Higgs sector.
Could I ask one question?
Yes. I have a question.
Yes, go ahead, Ivan.
Yeah. You speak about up and down spin. I think we are dealing with massless particles. They have helicity. And you speak left and right and up and down. To my understanding, the doubling comes not from up and down spin, but from particles and antiparticles. Perhaps we just have different terminology.
I see. Perhaps. So we're just taking spin up, and so like a, you know, vial spinner that you might write as a column vector, for example, will have spin up and spin down. Spin up and spin down states, as in like eigenstates of the, you know, Pauli matrix sigma 3. So I suspect that what you're describing should be equivalent. It sounds like it's counting the same number of degrees of freedom.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? In the cascade that you're in the green box there, all the steps look experimentally good except for the last one. I mean, somehow what you actually want experimentally is to break B minus L first.
Yes.
Without breaking the standard model.
Yes.
and then break the standard model down to SU3 times U1, whereas here the B minus L hangs around to the end. Do you have any thoughts about that? Or so, yes. I mean, of course, you don't want an unbroken B minus L.
Exactly.
Left after electroweak symmetry breaking.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. And I think Mia and I will, Mia will confirm that this is a bit of a thorn in our side. So prior to finding this kind of cascade of complex structures, we had been playing around with particle models and seeing how they're connected algebraically when you cast it into this language. And what we were finding is that, so this is what I was referring to when I said that there's a richer structure. So often you get these commuting diagrams. So kind of like what Bias and Huerta have in their commuting diagram with the FIN10 and the SU5 and Patti Salam and the standard model being the intersection. So you get commuting diagrams like this. So one of the directions tends to correspond to these complex structures. There's many ways of thinking about it. You can think about it in terms of complex structures or great involutions, Clifford algebraic great involutions. And the other direction is the steps that allow you to get chirality, and they're also the ones where it's easy to delete the B minus L symmetry. And there's many equivalent ways to think of, to characterize those steps. So we didn't present that kind of that direction in this model, which is why we're being punished now with the B minus L, which is lingering. Mm-hmm. So in future work, I think we'll flesh out more in more detail, basically the two directions where you can, mm-hmm. two different ways that you can break symmetries.
Okay, great. Yeah, I see there's one more question from Tejinder.
Thank you. Any ideas about how to get three fermion generations? In particular, what would happen if you started with F4?
Right. So I am actually going to have some comments about three generations at the end. So that you might be a little bit psychic, I guess. We are going to discuss three generations at the very end, but it's not going to relate to F4. So that should be coming up.
All right. Thanks. Great. So shall we switch slides? Is Mia going to share her slides now?
Yes. So I stop share here.
Okay. Thanks, Cole, for delivering that first half. And thanks again, everyone, for having me back to speak again for the second week in a row. We're perhaps slightly behind my expected schedule, so I better kick off. So first of all, I need to recap a little bit about chirality, just because I want to mention something about it later on. So we'll just need to quickly recap the math of that first. Then I'm going to quickly review again the RCHO model, and then we're going to look at the Patti Salam sort of sub model within that, and then how the Higgs fits into it. And if you see the way I type that, you can kind of guess something about it. So diving in. So in general, we could think of the division algebraic multiplication rule just in terms of, you know, in very general terms, as just a way to multiply basis elements. Multiplying one basis element by another basis element, EA, EB, gives you some linear combination of the other basis elements. And that those linear combinations could be written in terms of these structure constants T, A, B, C, which I'll come back to in a moment. The other thing is that there is a natural inner product on each division algebra. So if you take the real part, these angle brackets here mean real part. If you take the real part of psi star chi, where psi and chi are division algebra elements, and the star is like the generalization, you know, the conjugation that generalizes complex conjugation, then that just has the effect of essentially taking the Euclidean dot product basically between their vector, between these objects thought of as vectors. So what I want to talk about today then is if you multiply two elements of a division algebra K, let's say those elements are V and Psi, just using that rule I've written above, you get this bilinear product, which is also valued in K. And then if we take the inner product of that with a third element, this chi, then you end up with something real and trilinear in the three input vectors, V, Psi, and Chi. So each normed division algebra K gives rise to a trilinear form called a normed triality. So here I've written it as a function of T, V, a function T of V, Psi, and Chi. And it's just the real part of Chi star V, Psi, where you may notice I've omitted any brackets here for non-associativity, but that's because they, it turns out, under the angle bracket real part, it doesn't make any difference where you put those brackets. Okay, so this thing is a particular trilinear form on the on that vector space that we're calling K. Now, because of the division algebra property, the property that if you multiply two elements of a division algebra and they're not zero, you don't get zero. Because of that property, this trilinear form is non-degenerate. And it turns out because of the normed property, it's normed as well, where that's, I'll gloss over what that means exactly, because it's not particularly, I don't think it will be important for us here. Now, these kind of trialities, these trilinear forms, they're extremely rare. There's one for each normed division algebra and that's it. So their existence is in one-to-one, the existence of normed trialities is in one-to-one correspondence with the existence of division algebras. And here you can see why, because every time you have a normed triality, you can use it as the structure constants to build a division algebra. And every time you have a division algebra, you can build a normed triality. So you can think of the existence of these as fundamental to the division algebras. Now we might ask, what about the symmetries of these trialities? Well, if we treat the three inputs to the triality as if they belong to different spaces, we might ask, can we rotate each of them in such a way that preserves the trilinear form? So that is, if each of V, Psi, and Chi get their own orthogonal transformation, OV, O, Psi, O, Chi, each in the orthogonal group in that dimension, then, what's the subgroup that preserves this trilinear form? And the Lie algebras of those groups of automorphisms of the triality are called the triality algebras. And just listing them out here, we get the empty set for the reals, two U1s for C, three SU2s for H, and a single SO8 for trio. And if you saw my talk last week, I went into a lot more detail about that. So what's important here is to notice that each of the triality algebras consists of an SO dim K part plus an extra part. So in other words, there's an SO1 in for the reals, an SO2 for the complexes, an SO4 for the quaternions, an SO8 for the octonions, except there are these, there is just an extra U1 in the C case, an extra SU2 in the H case. Now under those orthogonal group, the algebras there, the SO1, SO2, SO4, SO8, the three inputs to the triality, the V, Psi, and Chi, they turn out to transform like the vector, the spinner and the conjugate spinner, or if you like, the left and right-handed vial spinners of SO dim K. And if you saw my talk last week and I mentioned how you could essentially think of the structure constants as like a set of Pauli matrices that kind of intertwine these three reps. So in particular, the triality scalar that you get can be thought of something like, chi bar V slash psi, basically. Okay. So the particular case that I'm going to be referring to is the less famous triality, the quaternionic triality. Now, it's a well-known fact about SO8 that there is this discrete triality symmetry, and it's reflected in the SO8 Dinkin diagram. But less commonly talked about is the discrete triality symmetry of SU2 plus SU2 plus SU2, which can also be seen in its Dinkin diagram. So in that quaternionic case, those three reps, the triality reps, transform like the 2, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and the 1, 2, 2. So writing them out here, you see that each transform with, I should say these thetas here represent imaginary quaternions in each case. So the vector transforms, they each transform with a theta from the left and a theta from the right. Now you can think of this as the V transforming like a vector, hence the notation, and then the psi and chi transforming like left and right-handed spinners under the SO4 generated by theta 1 and theta 2. And in that case, theta 3 is kind of like, is the extra SU2 that sits outside. And you can see that there, you know, the symmetry here is pretty clear. Each of them is kind of transforming in almost the same way. And you could just as well say that the SO4 is generated by theta 2 and theta 3, and under that psi is the vector, and V and chi are the spinners. Now you might be wondering why has one of them got a minus sign and the others are all positive? It's just, well, if you look at the back of the triality, it was built with chi star V and psi. So you could kind of think of the third rep as being chi star, in which case this one has two minus signs if I star this. So it's really, they're a jumble of minus signs around. Okay, right. So the thing to remember really is these three reps and these transformations. Okay, now coming back to our model. So as Cole said earlier on, an element psi of the Dixon algebra RCHO has 32 complex components, which is just right for a 16 copies of a left-handed SL2C vial spinner. So you could think of that as a 16 semicolon 2, 1 of SO10 plus SL2C. And I mean, that's just a quick way to notice that this might work. And in other words, an element of RCHO is perfectly suited to house one generation of standard model fermions. But how do you transform them correctly? Well, Cole already told you, but I'm going to remind you. So we have this way to write the transformations, which is of SO10. And that's just essentially taking these left multiplications by two octonions, two imaginary octonions, or two imaginary quaternions, or a combination of imaginary quaternion and imaginary octonion with this I there. If you don't have the I there, it would generate SO7, 3. Now, what we've done is just decomposed SO10 into SO7 plus SO3 plus a 7, 3, or if you like, MO cross MH. Now, it's fairly straightforward to convince yourself if you check things that the psi will transform as two copies of the 16 of SO10. But better still, it turns out that there's a way to write Lorentz symmetry in this story. So while the SO10 acts via left multiplication in the way which I've just sort of condensed down into this form with these Pauli matrices, which I forgot I haven't defined, but never mind. This transformation just represents the one on the previous page. So while the SO10 acts via left multiplication, the SL2C acts by right multiplication by complex imaginary quaternions. So a quick count will convince you that that's at least the right dimension for the Lorentz group. But of course, the imaginary quaternions generate SU2. And then if you multiply that by I, you get the boosts. So in fact, because this Lorentz symmetry is coming from right multiplication by the quaternions, it's guaranteed to commute with the SO10, since left and right multiplication in H commute, or in other words, H is associative. So we do indeed have a 16 semicolon 2,1 of SO10 plus SL2C. So in other words, 16 left-handed file spinners. Okay, so a quick word about Lagrangians. Well, so we can actually write the Lagrangian of any of these theories. First thing I should say is that if we want to see psi as an RCHO valued field in ordinary 4D Minkowski space, we can define this Dirac operator, which is so d slash psi, which looks like this. The fact that this has a different sign, the epsilon 2 term, just comes from is related to the fact that our SL2C comes from the right, and so we're essentially sort of, if you were to translate this into like complex 2x2 matrix language, it's as if we've transposed the Pauli matrices, and so we've ended up with a minus sign on sigma 2, which turns into epsilon 2. Anyway, whatever, it's for a technical reason that there's a minus, this has a different sign. But anyway, so this Dirac operator does the job, and then it turns out if you just take the real part of psi dagger d slash psi, then that works out to be exactly the same thing as the kinetic terms of 16 free two-component complex file spinners. Now I should say that what the dagger here means, that's just conjugation of all three division algebras at once. So complex conjugation, quaternionic conjugation, octonionic conjugation. So there's a very nice looking free Lagrangian, at least for this theory. Then if you want to include the gauge interactions, you can basically do this at any level in the cascade. You can either just take gauge fields valued in so vector gauge fields valued in SO10 or any of its subalgebras, and then promote the partial derivative to a covariant derivative, and then write the appropriate gauge invariant kinetic terms that way. So what I'm saying is that we also have a way to write the Lagrangians of any of the theories in this cascade. You might be asking, what about the mass terms? I'll come to those. Okay, so within that SO10 model, there is the Petit-Salam model. So let's have a quick look at that. So the Petit-Salam model, as Cole said, we can get it by asking what commutes with left multiplication by E7, or in various other, there's various other ways of characterizing it, but essentially amounts to the SO6 plus SO4 within SO10. And that's the same as an SU4 color, where we consider leptons to be the fourth color, an SU2 left that acts on the left-handed leptons, and an SU2 right that acts on the right-handed leptons. So that's the GPS algebra. So under this breaking, psi breaks into two irreducible representations, psi, what I call psi plus and psi minus. And there's a lot of labels here, so I'm going to quickly go through them one by one. Psi plus then is a four of the SU four color. It transforms as a two under SU2 left, and it's a singlet under SU2 right. And then it's a left-handed file spinner under SL2C. Psi minus is a four bar under SU4 color, a one under SU2 left, a two under SU2 right, and then it's a left-handed file spinner under SL2C. So psi plus contains a generation of left-handed fermions, and psi minus contains a generation of right-handed fermions. And the right-handed fermions here have been effectively charge conjugated. So that everything looks left-handed. Okay, so something smells like triality. Cole said that sounds like a fragrance. So I don't know what it would smell like. But anyway, so within SL2C, there is an SU2 spin, and that means that's the compact spatial rotation subgroup. So in fact, that means that there is a subalgebra, tri H, that lives inside the Petit Salam plus SL2C. And under this subgroup, the psi plus and psi minus transform like this, where theta left is an imaginary quaternion, theta spin is an imaginary quaternion, theta r is another imaginary quaternion. So that just looks very familiar. It looks a lot like the H triality thing we saw before. So psi plus can be thought of as four lots of the 2-1-2. Psi minus is four lots of the 1-2-2. So one might ask, what happened to the other rep, the 2-2-1, the third of the trio of things of reps that go into a norm triality. Spoiler alert: it could be the Higgs. So how do we represent the Higgs in our RCHO model? Well, it begins with an H, so it should be an H. So the SM Higgs has four real degrees of freedom and is a scalar with respect to SU2 spin. So it does make sense in some way, you might, at least on the surface, to make it into a pure quaternion. So it's a singlet of the SU4, a 2,2 of SU2 left and right, and a singlet under the space-time SU2 spin. So you might want to try this pure quaternionic Higgs and see what happens. Well, it turns out that does decompose into the right rep for the standard model electroweak Higgs under the decomposition of Petit Salam and Lorentz into standard model and SL2C. So there is a nice way to write that. And then the next question you might then ask is, well, what role does this trilinear scalar have to play? And that you'd immediately might guess that it's something to do with Yukawa terms. And it turns out that you can, if you write down the kind of the obvious thing here, you get, I should say here, psi tilde, it means H and O conjugated, but not C. And K here is just some constant. So you literally just write down the triality scalar, just as we wrote it down before. Earlier on, I wrote it as chi star V psi. You write down that thing with R psi plus and psi minus and H. And this really does break up into a bunch of Yukawa terms, just like the ones in the standard model. However, because they all have the same K outside, right now we would be getting all fermions with the same mass. But this is just, we're just looking at the Petit Salam level. Okay, so if I now expand out, right, well, yeah, I should comment on the fact that earlier on, what I was plugging into this triality scalar were three quaternions. Now I've got these RCHO pieces and a pure quaternion here. So I should really expand out the octonionic part of this. Doing so splits this into a sum of four terms, summing over the four colors, basically. So I get four terms. Now the psi plus and psi minus are valued in C cross H. And so finally, if I want this to be a true quaternionic triality, they should all be valued in H. So then I would take the real and imaginary parts of each of these psis, and I end up getting eight terms. So further splitting these psi plus A and psi minus A into their real and imaginary parts gives eight copies of the pure quaternionic triality scalar. as I said earlier, of course, once the Patti-Salam symmetry is broken to the standard model symmetry, the Yukawa terms would end up with different coupling constants, leading to the different masses of the standard model fermions. But at least at the Patti-Salam model, there is this curious appearance of something that looks like quaternionic triality in the Patti-Salam model. Okay, of course, it would be much nicer to find octonionic triality in the standard model. One idea for that, though undeveloped at this stage, is that the Patti-Salam, another Higgs that breaks the Patti-Salam symmetry to standard model symmetry might be written as an octonion or a complex octonion. Doing the counting, I think it has to be a complex octonion. This whole thing kind of raises the question of exactly what does, if given that the standard model can be written over RCHO, what exactly is the division algebraic multiplication rule supposed to be about? You know, what is there some role for the full triality? So far, this is just a hint at the quaternionic part. Okay, thanks for listening. That's it.
All right, thank you, Cole and Mia, for a terrific talk. So are there any questions?
I still have one final piece.
Oh, sorry, pardon me.
if you don't mind. I think the timing is a bit off, but it's just 5 minutes, so hopefully it shouldn't be too long here.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so let me, now how do I share screen?
Does Mia have to unshare first?
I think this should do it here. Okay. Play. Okay. Yes. Right. So sorry Mia about the timing there. I think that was poor planning on our part. So to conclude here, I just wanted to take a moment to tell you about some ideas that some collaborators and I are now looking into. So this is including Beth Romano, who's should also be here today. So this is a continuation of a three generations project from a few years back. And the idea is that all of the standard model's off-shell states, including its three generations, its gauge and Higgs bosons, should fit inside the Clifford algebra CL08. Now this might be appealing for a couple of reasons. So first of all, there's a pure counting argument. So as you know, the dimension of CL8 is 256. And now if you add up the standard model's off-shell states, including its right-handed neutrinos, the counting comes into 244 real degrees of freedom. So if you were to then say add 12 real degrees of freedom to this, then it would come up to 256. So that's the first potentially appealing feature of extending things in this way. Now, secondly, we've been able to find a simple SU3 action, which gives 220 degrees of freedom transforming in agreement with the standard model. So these lambdas here, are the usual SU3 generators that we're all used to using. And the P in this action here is an idempotent, which in this case is based on the octonionic imaginary unit E7. Now under this SU3 action, we find that CL8 breaks down in this way, where the C36 here that I wrote at the end is a 36 dimensional space, which is misbehaving. Okay, so just to give you an idea, we can suggest for you what these irreducible representations could correspond to. So here's one example. These four copies of the adjoint could correspond to off-shell degrees of freedom for gluons. Then next we might have here, say, a photon and a Z boson. Then in the next set here, we've got potentially we could have six types of quarks, including their spin up and down in their chirality left and right states. The next we could have, this next set could correspond to six types of leptons without right-handed neutrinos. And then finally, one might expect that the missing W bosons, Higgs, and right-handed neutrinos should sit in this 36-dimensional space. So this isn't the full 244 degrees of freedom of the standard model transforming perfectly under SU3 color, but it's 220, so it's pretty close. Okay. Now, finally, if we zoom out, the bigger picture is that this simple SU3 action can be generalized to something which we're going to call a multi-action. So here's an example of what such a multi-action might look like, where the dagger, you can define it in various ways. So these P's here, again, those are idempotents, and the A's and B's, those are elements of the Clifford algebra. Now, this multi-action you can show can split the Clifford algebra into Lie algebras into different subspaces. And under this, you can think of the multi-action as like a multiplication rule. So under the multi-action, we get pieces that behave like Lie algebras, Jordan algebras, and spinner spaces. Now, one idea is that there could be an idea to extend this is that there could be different multi-actions corresponding to different energy scales. So the idea is that each energy scale should have its own multi-action, and therefore each energy scale will correspond to a certain set of idempotents. So the idea then is that we should be able to relate different energy scales by coarse graining these sets of idempotents. Now, in the project that, in the one generation project that Mia and I just completed, we did in fact have different complex structures corresponding to different energy scales. So the idea is that we might be able to connect our current results to them all to the multi-action by building these projectors from these complex structures. So for a couple of years now, I've been circulating some of these CL8 findings amongst colleagues, and many of those colleagues are here today. And in fact, if you're curious, the details are available online. So I did write them into the appendix of this paper. So they are on the archive, but they're in hiding at the back of a paper. Okay, so in summary, some of us are now planning on seeing what can be done with the CL8 in relation to this standard model. Okay, so this is all that we wanted to say. So thank you to everybody for attending our talk.
All right, thank you very much to both of you for a great talk. Does anyone have any further questions?
Did we start 1 hour earlier than usual today?
Yes. Did I not? I sent a
no. Well, I got your message, but it's an EST, right? So I don't have an immediate. A conversion to CET, which is what I'm on.
Oh yes. We did.
I just didn't realize it was.
Yes. Sorry, Paul. Yes, we did. We did start an hour.
So yeah.
And that will be true. Just to clarify, that'll be true next week also. And then after that, the whole world will be on the same daylight savings time, and we'll be back to the old schedule.
Oh, I see. You change. Oh, in the U.S. Ah, no.
North America changes 2 weeks earlier. Yeah.
Ah, I see. Okay, so there's you haven't changed the time. It's just that the time.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I sent out a clarification email over the weekend, but I may have somehow not sent it to you, or I'm not sure.
I didn't get any clarification, but I didn't see the clarification. Anyway.
But the video of this talk is available. So
yeah, there was a note to that. So thanks. Yes.
I see there's a question from Tejinder. Go ahead.
Thank you. So Cole, I had a question. How do you do quantum field theory? Would you do conventionally Lagrangian for gauge fields and fermions with the SO10 gauge invariance on a flat four-dimensional Minkowski space time. What have I gained from the octonions? Do I go back to doing ISO 10 gauge theory?
So far everything that we've been doing is just group representation theory, and you could, there's no reason why you couldn't, build a quantum field theory out of it, kind of in the regular way. Like it's really no different than having a bunch of matrices acting on column vectors, or like the usual group representation theory formalism. I think one of the things, as Kirill mentioned actually in his talk, one of the things that you get that's extra from the octonions, because you could say, well, what's the difference between just having like a matrix algebra acting on a column vector? Like, what are you doing that's different? You're just using the octonions as a vector space. And one of the things that Kirill had pointed out, which we had also, Mia had also, and I had also thought of as well, is that especially in this one, in this step, like when you go from the spin 10 to the Patti-Salam and then to the left-right symmetric model, where you're left multiplying and then right multiplying octonions, and you're using that to break the symmetry down. And if you were to just write that in terms of matrices and column vectors, like that would seem really arbitrary, like especially the complex structure coming from right multiplication by the octonions. Like if you were just working with matrices and column vectors or tensor algebras, like you wouldn't think to use that complex structure.
Okay.
And it takes as both Latham and Kirill pointed out, that will take you directly from SO10 down to the left right symmetric model, the right multiplication piece.
And there would be no gravity at any stage. What kind of energy scales do you think? This is a guts kind of 10 to the 14th and the 15 GeV. There's no gravity, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, we haven't worked anything along those lines yet.
Yeah. And lastly, you mentioned coarse graining. Did you have in mind space-time scale coarse grainings so that you come to larger length scales and lower energies?
By coarse graining there, there probably is a better technical mathematical term to use for it. But basically what you have is you've got sets of idempotents. And at the higher energy scales, you have a smaller set. And then when you go to the lower energy where the symmetry is are broken, then you're basically multiplying projectors together. And so you get a larger set of projectors. And that happens again at the next step where you're kind of multiplying these like sets of projectors are getting larger in the so you're kind of like adding a complex structure at every step. And so if you go the opposite direction from low energy to high energy, then it looks like a coarse graining of sets of projectors. So that's what I meant concretely about that term.
Could I think of it as that as I go to higher energies and I probe smaller length scales, I start seeing something like an eight-dimensional octonionic space-time, and then come to lower energies, I see effective four-dimensional space-time? No, not that.
I don't think so. So for us, anyway, we've got. Mia, did you want to answer? I can answer, Mia, whatever. I just didn't want to hog all the the collaborations.
You go on.
Okay. So we've got SL2C. It's the complex quaternions right multiplying onto the algebra that is describing the space-time transformations all the way up. So even at the that was actually one of the nice things that turned out with our construction, as Mia pointed out in her part of the talk, was that if you take the SO10 action on our CHO and you look for the maximal subalgebra of the whole Clifford algebra CL10 that commutes with that SO10, it turns out that you get SL2C. Plus a trivial factor. So it's actually, we've got 3+1 space time all the way up.
Yeah, that bothers me, you see, because on the one hand, we have these eight dimensional numbers, but we want to restrict our space time to four dimensions. On the other hand, if we recall, say, what was done in string theory, we looked at the situation like SO19 is isomorphic to SL2O, and that is very appealing. That's something like I'm doing quantum field theory in 9 + 1 dimensions, and maybe I compactify 6 of them, and I come to 4-dimensional space-time. So there, in the original 10D Minkowski space equivalent to 8 octonionic dimensions, I see the power of octonions. But when I'm doing everything in 4-dimensional space-time, the octonions seem to become just a tool for a representation of, you know, the standard model. It would be very nice if we started thinking in terms of extending space-time dimensions to either, 9 + 1 or 8 octonionic. That is, in my opinion, where you see the real power of doing quantum field theory with the Dixon algebra. You know, we have talked about it.
Yeah. For me, I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to the idea of interpreting it, this as being a higher dimensional model, but like Mia is actually the one who's an expert on this topic. So I don't know if she's got anything to add to that.
I obviously, in my talk last week, I was talking about exactly that, the SL2O as SO1,9. In string theory, I mean that was kind of like the main theme of my PhD was sort of rewriting stuff in string theory in terms of octonions.
Yeah, it would be nice if what you said last week and what we heard today, if somehow we could bring this together and say that the Dixon algebra actually becomes important in a 10-dimensional Minkowski space.
That certainly would be nice.
I was going to ask something similar, just to say it again. Is there do you see any connection or any tentative connection between what you spoke about this week and what you spoke about last week?
It would have to be very indirect, because most of what I was speaking about last week, like the magic square, for example, that was in 3 space-time dimensions, not very physical at all.
Right.
However, you could ask instead, though, what about, the fact that you can write, you can phrase statements in 10D space-time in terms of this 2x2 octonionic language. Does that have anything to do with what we're doing now? There are links. There are some obvious links, because, like, for example, a 2x2, the algebra of 2x2 complex matrices is the same as complex quaternions, and so 2x2 octonionic matrices looks not so different from RCHO.
Yeah, I agree.
But so far, no obvious connections.
Okay, thank you. I see there's a question in the chat from Namrata. She says, for Mia, when you mention C equals imaginary part of H, what do you mean by imaginary H? It was after you mentioned Lorentz symmetry.
Yes, sorry. I probably assumed something, that notation was more standard than it was. What I meant was the space of... I think I wrote C tensor imaginary part of H. So when I said imaginary part of H, I literally just meant the space of quaternions that can be written just in terms of like I, J, and K with no real part, just as a summary.
Yeah, I didn't want to confuse it with like the complex
it gets a bit confusing when you have these when you're saying something like quaternionic imaginary but complex,
right?
Complex wise has a real and imaginary part, quaternionic wise it's pure imaginary. So what we were doing was representing the Lorentz symmetry as the Lorentz generators, or rather the Lie algebra of SL2C as the space of imaginary quaternions with complex coefficients, if that makes sense.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Shane, do you have a question?
I had a quick question for Mia. You mentioned at the very end of your talk that after the breaking down to the Senin model, you expected different masses for the particles. Could you say a little bit more about what you mean there? In particular, I'm guessing you just mean between the neutrinos and electrons and between quarks and leptons, not between the different generations, right? How does that story play out? And can you make a prediction at all?
That's a good question. What I really meant by that comment was, I'll just go back to my slides one second. I just meant that with this Yukawa term that I had written down, inspired by this quaternion and triality, if I took this as the standard model, Lagrangian, I would predict that all part, as the Yukawa sector of the standard model, I would predict that all the fermions have the same mass. So I guess all I meant really by that comment was that this isn't the Yukawa sector of the standard model, Lagrangian. This is just a term that you might expect to find in the Patisse-Lahn Lagrangian. So as to exactly how the different fermions would end up with different masses, that would depend on however one goes about breaking Patisse-Lahn up into the standard model symmetries. But so far, what we've talked about is just this algebraic way of seeing these symmetry breaking patterns, but we've been somewhat agnostic about whether that corresponds to some Higgs mechanism that's occurring. So without saying exactly how, physically how the symmetries are broken, only algebraically, I don't think I can say exactly how this would become the standard model term. So I wouldn't be able to make a prediction at this stage as to any masses.
Well, could I just add one quick comment to that? I'm very interested in this triality idea and this and getting the Higgs from triality. I mean, I think I'm very sympathetic with it, I should say. I think it looks really like a very nice thing, and I've been kind of thinking about it, something similar. And one thing that I run into is that H, which is a doublet under both SU2 left and SU2 right, is exactly the charge of the Higgs that is introduced in the standard left-right symmetric standard model to write down the Yukawa couplings. But then that H by itself can't break you down to the standard model. It can't break left-right symmetry. And so maybe part of the answer to Shane's question is that, there has to be, my impression is that there has to be some other ingredient to achieve the symmetry breaking down to the standard model, some other Higgs field or something like that. And I haven't personally figured out what that would or should be or something, but that's maybe related.
Same here, really. I mean, like I was saying in my final slide, I had some speculation that maybe there is another Higgs field, which instead of being a pure quaternion was something else, and
right,
that would be the thing that breaks the down from just kind of more. But right now, that's just kind of
right.
Cheers.
Carol?
Yeah, I also have a question, so I think. My question comes in two parts. One of them I already asked you by email, but I don't know, maybe you know the answer now. So the first part is, so you identified Lorentz group and spin 10 acting on your RHCO, on your division algebra. But there should surely be more. So the question is, do you know I'm not sure if it's well posed, but do you know the largest Lie group that naturally acts on this division algebra? So that's my first part. And the second part is, assuming there is more, what breaks it down to spin 10 times Lorentz?
Question.
Yeah.
I don't think I understood why do you say that there should be more? I'm not sure I followed that.
You were shown, so there is this division algebra, some transformations from the left act in one way, and Lorentz act from the right. but you can act from the right with more generators, right? There's surely more transformations that act on this division algebra. You simply didn't look at them, but of course one can, and there is some larger set of transformations that act there. So of course it's important to identify what they are. Because there is more, there must be some mechanism that breaks it down to spin 10 times Lorentz. I don't know, have you thought about this at all? Or?
Cole, what do you
think? can you hear me? Oh, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Can you hear me? Yes, okay. It's a good question. So, and this is something that Mia and I have discussed before as well too, like it's not entirely clear kind of what the correct starting point should be. So we could go with, some, as you mentioned, we could go with something that's larger than spin 10. My personal inclination, I don't know if, I don't know where Mia's at with this, is actually to go down. So I'm a little bit more inclined to have the sense that the Patisse-Lhomme might actually be the correct starting point. One of the reasons is because is actually because of these multiplication algebras. So you can, so the spin 10 to me doesn't feel like it feels like it's well motivated in the sense that it's a, we've got 32 complex dimensional spinner, and that's you know, that's kind of like the, well, I guess you get a 16 and a 16 star kind of.
My question is about strange transformations which are not the ones that were used in particle physics, right?
Yeah, so there's other ones. So there are ones that we were thinking about before, even like you can think of a complexified SO10, for example, and that's a larger, like that's in a larger group that will still act on that.
It does both. It acts as spin 10 and it mixes with Lorentz generator.
Ah, I see, okay, yes. Great, right. So yeah, you could do
that. If you take some transformations from there, from the right, some from the left, you get very strange transformations, which do not correspond to anything we know. What yeah. about them?
Yes, no, so it's a good question. So it's not entirely sure what the correct starting point is. Like, and again, like, so I can only, you know, I have a slight preference to actually starting with the Patisse-Lhomme for a couple of reasons. One is that, so RCHO splits really nicely into the tensor product over C of C cross H and C cross O. And from there, each of those have a multiplication algebra, which is complex CL4 and complex CL6. So there's a natural SO4, SO6 kind of split there. And so that seems to be kind of a nice entrance for the...
If Lorentz is there, then there is always a possibility of taking mixed transformations.
You could, but I'm just saying that. So this is, to me, this is what looks the most natural. And the other reason why I might like that is actually related to this this trying to extend this to three generations problem and sticking it into CL8. So the CL8 only has enough room for 16 real degrees of freedom for Higgs bosons in total. And that would might fit all right with the Patisse-Lhomme model, but once you go to spin 10, I think you're looking at Higgs bosons to break spin 10 that are you need too large, the representations get too big. So again, but this is, you know, complete speculation, and you're asking a question, so it's not clear like what's the best starting point.
But I guess I'm trying to understand the role of Lorentz group in your.
Yeah, just something to add to that is that if we were to take, let's say we were to build something out of simultaneous left and right, such that the Lorentz group didn't commute with that, there seems like there would be some limit to how big the thing you could build would be, because, I mean, aside from the roof of the dimension of the whole space, but that's because from the right, the only thing you have on the right that coming from the right that commutes with everything on the left is the three imaginary quaternionic units. And so whatever extra generators you were trying to build that don't commute with SL2C, they would have to be something just with those three units, and then something on the right. And that seems like quite a, strong constraint on what you could build that was larger. So I agree, you probably could build bigger, you probably could build some bigger algebras. We haven't really tried building the biggest possible thing.
Well, another thing to say to you, I did, I'm unmuted here. So, and so maybe this is kind of part of what you were getting at, was that, so because of the way that the algebra multiplies, you're always going to have an SL2C coming from the right, which is going to commute with everything else. So, so actually there will never be mixing with that. If you identify that, say, right multiplication by SL2C, as we did, with this, you know, Lorentz symmetries, then no matter what, no matter how big you make the internal symmetry group, it's never going to mix with that SL2C, because that piece of the multiplication algebra is it commutes with everything else. I don't know if maybe Mia, you said that, but so we're not going to you won't get something that mixes in.
Oh, right. We're entering a technical discussion, so maybe we shouldn't. But yeah, there is this question about is there more transformations in your scheme of things which mix Lorentz with internal symmetries? And I'm not convinced that there is. Well, I'm not convinced because I should explain where these questions come from. So I'm looking at spinor representations of 11.3, right? Of course, 11.3 has spin 10 and Lorentz. And I know that this spinor representation of 11.3 can be identified with CHO. And so I know that I can think about your construction in terms of representations of 11.3 acting on this space.
Yeah.
There will be other transformations which are not Lorentz and which are not spin 10, but the mixed transformation.
I see. That's perfect. That makes sense to me because it's exactly what I just said. Like the other piece in SO 11, 3, 11.3, sorry, is that is exactly the the three. It's going to have the imaginary turning on units. On
then the big question is what breaks that big group down to Lorentz and spin 10.
That's an interesting question. I mean, maybe there's another complex structure.
Well, yeah, there is a complex structure, yeah, but well, so where is it coming from then?
I guess we'll find out.
I don't think complex structure answers this question, but again, maybe we shouldn't go there. Anyway, thank you for your answer.
Okay, great. Well, so that. Yeah, given the time, and maybe we should cut it off there. But so let's thank Cole and Mia one more time for an extremely interesting and stimulating talk.